For those of you who don't remember me, don't know me, I was the minister here for 8 years, quite a long time ago. We left, as John said, about 12, 13 years ago. And we left here to go to North Wales, where we were for 6 years, and then we moved to North London, very close to where we'd been in the previous appointment, and we were there for 4 years in Haringey, just about to extend for another five-year extension there, when I got moved by the president of conference, which very occasionally happens to ministers, and told me that I was moving to Notting Hill. I was not aware that there were particular issues at Notting Hill or there needed to be a minister there. I'd never been to worship at the church, maybe once 30 years previously, and I didn't even know where it was. And within a very short space of time, find myself being the minister at Notting Hill. And we moved into the area in April 2017, a few weeks before the Grenfell Tower fire happened. So I'd been in the area about 6 months, full-time for about six months. I knew the area for maybe about 9 months. We hadn't been living in the area for very long. And as you'll see, the church is very close to Grenfell Tower, and the church's life has been very much involved with that appalling tragedy ever since. So I'll try and share a few things about what I've learned, and to an extent I'm still learning, really, about the area, about what the church can and should be doing there, and maybe that might help other people such as yourselves reflect on perhaps your mission in this area, in this circuit, and so on, perhaps. Can I have the next slide? I'm going to have to keep on saying next, because we haven't got any special fancy devices here to do that. This is what Grenfell Tower looks like now. And that's the image that certainly for people within the local community we prefer to show, which is the tower that is now a 24-storey tower, shrouded in plastic sheeting. It's floodlit at night at the top and has got the green heart, which has now become the Grenfell symbol. And in front of it is the local secondary school. The picture is actually taken from just outside the church door. It's very close indeed. But I'll show you just a couple of pictures of what it used to look like before it was shrouded. And almost everybody feels that being covered in the way that it is a very good thing, for reasons that I'll come on to, but probably fairly self-explanatory. So I think let's have the next one. That's the kind of that's still the image which Reuters uses when it talks about Grenfell Tower fire. It's one of the iconic images, partly because it was where the camera crews were allowed to be on the day after the fire, and we happened to be in the line of sight, and perhaps it just meant, I'm not sure if it's good photography, but it was a provocative and image where you've got our church spire right in front of Grenfell Tower, the burnt out image. And our church tower is currently in the midst of scaffolding and being refurbished. But that's the image which, you know, went around the whole world, really. So our church's spire, at least, is now, I suppose, iconic, to use that overused word. But if I now have the next slide, it'll just show you a little bit of where we are. Now, I haven't got a big pointer. No, I haven't. But this is taken from the north, and you can see Grenfell Tower, and the odd-shaped building at the bottom is the local secondary school. To the right of Grenfell Tower, and it's hard to make out, are lots of other buildings which are put up almost exactly the same time, which are part of the Lancaster West housing estate. They are almost like horizontal blocks of flats, several stories high, and they're called the walkways or the finger blocks, and there are three principally of them, and a small one which actually is almost adjoining Grenfell Tower, but you can't really see it on this particular photo. But if I show you on this one, if Grenfell Tower is here, you might just be able to make out there's a church over here about halfway up on the left-hand side, and that's the Methodist Church. There's also a number of other churches almost as close as we are, but you're talking about 150, 200 yards. It's very close indeed. And there's actually a walkway between this school at the front and the leisure centre that's behind. So we happened, by pure bad luck, to be very close to Grenfell Tower fire. when that tragedy happened, and I was called at about 5 o'clock in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, was told that Grenfell Tower was on fire, and then, as loads of other people did, simply milled around the local area, wondering to see what was going on, and then discovering that very little was actually going on apart from the actual firefighting operation. And so people were outside in the street in their 90s, in their boxer shorts with blankets around them, and a whole load of unimaginable chaos on the streets for many, many hours, and some very impromptu reception centres that were being set up in churches and community centres and so on. We couldn't set one up in our church because the church at the time was within the cordoned off area. It was that close. And I think the emergency services were very frightened that the tower might collapse, in which case they wanted, obviously, to keep people at a safe distance from the place. If I can have the next slide. That's a really exciting one, just of boxes. But as you probably know, what happened in the ensuing days, even on the first day, is that the church and many other centres got involved in a huge impromptu relief response. Some of that happened because people wanted to offer help and support to the emergency services. So people were bringing lots of water, for instance, for the firefighters and for the police crews and so on. And they were very grateful of this. Other people were bringing along clothes because it was very evident that we had many hundreds of people who had been immediately made homeless. We didn't know what their condition it was, but we knew we've got lots of people, hundreds of people made homeless. And clearly they haven't got any clothes. They need things to wear, even if just for now, just for today. So people were bringing all kinds of clothes and food items and so on, really just thinking about the next day or two. And the whole thing snowballed very quickly into a huge relief operation, which was immensely chaotic. Nobody seemed to know what anybody else was doing, perhaps inevitably. But we also had no guidance from anybody as to what might be happening. So the rumours that were going round the day were extraordinary. At one point, we were told with some great authority by other people, but no one in authority themselves, that we were the place which would receive all the bedding equipment. So other centres were bringing us and dumping on us all their blankets and all their bedding equipment. So we're preparing for all those things, but in fact, neither we nor anywhere else was used as an overnight stay centre on the first night. And everybody, in fact, was then at the very late hour, about 10 o'clock at night, told that they would be going to the sports centre, where they'd be sleeping the night there instead. So a huge amount of chaos. And lots of people bringing goods, which were really helpful in the first few hours, but as time went on, became less and less helpful. So within a day or two, we had people driving halfway around the country bringing us things because they'd seen the pictures on television, were incredibly moved, very compassionate about and wanting to help, and bringing us vast amounts of goods that we could never possibly use. Just in our church, we had enough toothbrushes, probably for much of the population of the borough. I mean, thousands of toothbrushes. And we did actually give out some toothbrushes. There were people who did need them, but not thousands of them. And it's very hard to tell people who've driven 100 miles that actually you can't. Can you take your stuff back home, please, with you? You can't do that. And we had a lot of very, very upset and rather angry people at times who were wanting to help. And that became part of the difficulty too. Amidst a relief effort which was largely run by the local community and in an incredibly resourceful way, people managed to find all kinds of things very quickly, like enormous numbers of boxes they blagged off a local removal firm, storage, vans, airtight containers for all the foodstuffs. So IKEA managed to somehow drop off a vast quantity of stuff some point during that first day because somebody knew somebody who knew somebody in IKEA, for instance, and that was replicated 100-fold in different ways. So our building was taken over with people with masking tape and sticky tape and marker pens and everything else for the first few days, many of whom we did not know, and it was a confusing kind of whirlwind where we insisted that everybody had to have a label so we knew what their first name was. Everybody had to wear a badge saying what their name was. But it was this huge assortment of different people which raised all kinds of ethical questions for me. Do we throw out, for instance, what's the group? It wasn't the Christian Scientists. Who was the group that we had? Oh, I think it was the Mormons. Do we throw out the Mormons who came with bright yellow T-shirts saying, you know, Mormons on it or something like that? And in the end, I just said, no, if people help me, I'll just let them do whatever they want to do. In fact, the Mormons weren't trying to necessarily convert people to being Mormons. They were just there to help. We probably had a third of the people in the building at any one time were Muslim. I know they were Muslim because most of them were women and most of them were wearing hijabs or burqas or niqabs of some kind. Some would shake hands with me and some wouldn't. I remember at one particular point on the second day, we needed someone who spoke Farsi. And I went down into the basement and yelled out in a loud voice, "Anyone here speak Farsi?" And about 20 hands went up. Is quite interesting, the number of different languages and nationalities that people belong to. Anyway, if I can go to the next slide, which just shows a really dynamic picture of boxes being loaded onto one of the smaller vans that we had. Most of the clothes in the end we gave to Red Cross, and they were sold to raise money for Grenfell. But a lot of the other goods we kept on site, the more kind of hygiene, sanitary stuff, And they were used over the next few months, and we distribute them ourselves. Can I have the next one, please? I've just got a few photos now, which simply show you some of the kind of tributes and memorials that people placed. In the first few hours, nothing like that was done. People were still very much in shock and wanting to do something, bring water, bring food, bring clothing, and so on. At about lunchtime on the first day, a chap called Alan, who was a local big issue seller, and his dog, came and placed a small bunch of flowers on our railings. By the evening, that had mushroomed into a much larger collection. This photo was taken, I think, on the Saturday, 3 days afterwards. And we just became one of the places, there's about three or four in the area, where people, it was like a magnet for people to come and lay candles and leave pictures and attach things to our railings. That raises whole other issues, which I may come to later if I've got time, because we still have things attached to our railings. We have probably 20 or 30 teddy bears still imprisoned against our railings, against their wishes. And that raises all kinds of difficult questions about how long you leave memorials and how you care for them and all the sensitivities around memorials, which, of course, was completely unaware of. So people started laying candles and other memorials. If we can go to the next, you can just see some. And we realised that people had a very profound sense of wanting to do something and to express themselves over the forthcoming days, often in ways which we ourselves found hard to understand. So you can see there against, this is the Latimer Christian Centre, people have scrawled things on whiteboards that were put up, and then when they were filled, they put out more whiteboards, which then got filled again. And this desire to fill things. On the first day, we brought some books we could use as condolence books. And within about 2 weeks, we'd gone through 15 books, just in our church alone, let alone the things that were being scrawled everywhere else. I'll show you some of the graffiti in a minute. And as some of you who remember me know, I'm a typical white northern boy, really. I mean, a good firm handshake is all that I want. Please don't kind of, you know, kiss me or hug me. I'm not kind of that tactile a person. I don't want to write things in plasticine or flowers or so on. But many people do. And it's been quite interesting to actually how important it can be for people to express things in all kinds of different ways and to allow people to be able to do that. So if I show the next, probably just some other kind of ones. Even by the first day, posters were going up which said wanted or have you seen, and the picture of the person, quite a few were photocopied in our building, in fact. But it was clear that often these posters were effectively saying RIP, I think. People knew that deep down they probably wouldn't be found, many of them. And there's still, some of them that are still there are still very, very poignant indeed. Next one. That's a few days afterwards with the just outside the Methodist Church. And you can see the number of, you can't see the railings for the number of flowers that people have attached. And we learned some things that were very helpful. simply that it's very useful to have an awful lot of water bottles, which you can cut open and use as impromptu vases. We would let people do their own things and simply leave scissors and tape and bottles for people to do their own thing outside. And that seemed to be something that resonated very strongly. Rather than us saying, this is what you can do in this particular way, simply offering a whole range of things and saying, you do your thing. And somehow we will honour and respect that. On the first night, having had a, as you can imagine, a fairly fraught and exhausting day, with the church full of volunteers, none of whom I knew or had met before, we thought it would be good, first of all, to give the volunteers a break, but also to stop for a minute or two. And we decided to hold a vigil at 8 o'clock. And none of us know really what to do. There's nothing in the books or the training colleges which says this is how you hold a vigil in the middle of a very tragic event. So we hunted around the building, found a piece of purple cloth, threw it over the railing, which is now obscured by the flowers, got a few candles from the church, put some photocopied sheets up saying we'll have a little prayer vigil at 8 o'clock, and informed everybody in the building that that's what we would do. And at 8 o'clock, you know, I don't know, 150 people stopped working, and they all trotted outside and stood there in silence. And other people joined them outside. And it was incredibly moving. And they said, Rev, you did a great job. Loved what you said. Well, I have to, in all honesty, I didn't say very much, and nor anything particularly memorable. But it was the fact that giving people the occasion simply to stop and reflect and to do so together with other people, Muslim and Christian and of no faith, I think was very helpful for people. And all the more, I suppose, scary for me, going home. I got home just after midnight that night. As I got home, Susie said, oh, guess what? She just looked on the BBC website. You're the front page news. Vigil at Methodist Church. So, okay, that's very stressful. I didn't even realise there was any kind of media people there at the vigil. And of course, then the whole thing snowballs to you get far more people the following night, and it kind of escalates. But clearly, people need to have some outlet, some way of expressing, well, the inexpressible, I suppose. Next one, Kevin, please. We learned a lot of lessons in the first few days, one of which was from the Ascension Trust, who also run street pastors. And they were brilliant at helping us and guiding us. One lesson they had learned from the Manchester Arena terror attacks, which had happened only a few weeks before Grenfell Tower fire, was to create a press-free zone. And we didn't know anything about the law or how the press work at all. But apparently if you cordon off an area and you say no press, the press code of practice means that they can't really cross it because they've been asked by the public not to. And they respected it, even though I was actually doing it on land that was not ours but belonged to the council. And so we managed to create and keep the press back, and we developed a fairly good working relationship with a lot of the press over the next few weeks. They got to know us, and in some cases that's developed on since, you know, for the last 2 years really. And we've learned to how to work with each other. Next one, please. Some graffiti went up very, very quickly. That was up within about a week, I think, believe it or not. People arrived with spray paint and ladders and a lot of anger on the streets. I'll talk about the anger in a moment. And if we go on to the next one, an awful lot of religious graffiti as well. How many places would you find whole texts from the Bible and whole psalms printed out in protest at what has been happening? But it is quite interesting that people turn to verses from the Quran and the Bible as a way of expressing how strongly they feel. So we have 1 Corinthians, we have John 11, and if we go on to the next ones, you'll just see a few more. I suspect this is the work of just a very small number of individuals because the writing looks similar. But this next one, but you just this just gives you the idea of the kind of thing. Psalm 72, if you can't read all the words. And most of these are still up in the local area. Next one. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted, which is under the Westway, the sort of motorway that cuts through the local area. Next one. I think you saw that one earlier. Next one. Psalm 61, or at least a version of it. Next one. And a lot of anger about the local authorities. So I think about a week after the fire, we found that people had started plastering these over the road signs, changing the Royal Borough to the Rotten Borough. And ever since, occasionally they reappear and are then removed as soon as they appear by the local council officials. But that attitude is prevalent amongst many in the local community in which I happen to be, which is, I should have said earlier, very... it's very multiracial, it's very multi-faith. It has an area which has gross income and wealth inequalities. Some of the poorest wards in the country are in North Kensington, and some of the richest people on the planet live within a few hundred yards of them as well. You have incredibly stark contrast of wealth and poverty and very, very different worlds. So on the Lancaster West Estate and nearby, we have significant overcrowding, for instance, amongst many people who live in the area, where you might have many people living in the same room, children who grow up never having their own bedroom. I know of, amongst church members, for instance, people who will share bedrooms with their teenage children because there are no other rooms for them to live in, with all the consequent issues about privacy and about being able to invite friends back and have friends to play and having your own sense of space and so on. And that's part of the mix of the whole area, really, which has created huge anger locally at what is seen to be a local authority that does not represent the local people of North Kensington. So, next one. We had all kinds of things given to us, some of which we didn't want. One of which we did want was a 7-foot granite statue, which somebody simply made for us and offered. And I was amazed the church too had said they liked it and would take it. But I think it's, in some ways, because it is so modern, so brutalist, it does seem to fit really with the local area. So that's now in permanent position outside our church. And at the bottom of it is the date of the fire. Next one. Some local school children have been involved in all kinds of art projects, and many of them were displayed by the local tube station. Hundreds and hundreds were done by local children, and only a few of the best ones were selected. When our church had to be covered in hoardings and scaffolding, we decided to actually put up a lot of the other artwork that was that the children had done, which could not be displayed outside the tube station. So it didn't cost us very much money because the kids had done the artwork. We just needed to have it laid out on these laminated sheets. And that has now become what the press call a memorial wall. And now it'll be difficult to take down when the scaffolding is removed next week, so we'll have to find some way of keeping all these things because people have now scrawled other messages on top of them. But some of them are interesting. They were asked, the children in the local primary schools were asked simply to say or to draw something about someone they liked or something that they wanted to say thank you to. And you probably can't see. If you still look at the second row down, next to the very far left, it's hard to see, but there's a picture of two firefighters in that particular heart. And that was done by Luya, who's known to me and is a friend, a very close friend of someone in the church. And she and her mum were taken out unconscious from Grenfell Tower fire. And I remember her friend at 5 o'clock in the morning of the night of the fire being incredibly agitated. We wandered around the streets together trying to find news of her friend and her daughter, not knowing what had happened to them, whether they had got out, whether they were alive or dead. And it took 24 hours to discover the news that both had been carried out alive, but overcome by smoke, and in fact had been placed in different hospitals. And so, of course, for quite a while, didn't know how the other had actually fared in the fire. And still today are significantly scarred by their experiences. Next one. I don't want to go too much over all the immediately aid response, except to say, as I think I said earlier, that it was a phenomenal community response. And you realise how brilliant people can be in very extreme situations. and how people can pull together and organise themselves without any sense of hierarchy and without any kind of sense of rancour. You do see people at their very, very best at what is also a very, very stressful and pressured time. One of the reports that was written soon after the fire by an organisation commissioned by Muslim Aid, you may not be able to see the words, but simply praised the local Muslim and Christian organisations and their leadership, because it talked about them offering trusted expert assistance to communities. And part of that is simply having the infrastructure of a faith organisation that can actually be there and have a building, for instance, which you can make use of, and having people who can be go-to people and people who are, at least have some kind of, with the exception of me, a kind of track record in the local community of being involved, being on the side of the local community, understanding the local people, and so on. So we like to quote the Muslim Aid report because it does, in the face of so much that is negative about faith communities, actually say what a positive role faith communities do play. Next one. One of my colleagues is Alan Everett, who's the local Church of England vicar, and he wrote a book called After the Fire, Finding Words for Grenfell. And I just, then, this is probably too small to read, but it says this: in the days and weeks following the fire, we faced the prospect of compound trauma. Not everyone who was traumatised was lonely, vulnerable and poor, but many were. And so places of worship needed to be accessible to everyone. They needed to be recognised places of safety and nurture, and to offer pastoral care without an ensuing sense of obligation. Those who turned up for help needed to find themselves in the presence of others like themselves, to whom they could easily relate. In times of crisis, places of worship and community centres are ideally both in and of the areas they serve. And I think that's kind of incarnational ministry, really, about being in and of the areas they serve. A place of worship which is populated by local people, and so when people go, they recognise this is us, and we feel safe here, and it's okay. Next one. I've tried to summarise a few things the faith community did in the immediate response. First of all, and again, this was quite an extraordinary situation that's probably been since very old news now, but the local authority really didn't do very much in the first few days in terms of coordinating any kind of visible response. And therefore, it was left to the voluntary sector and faith communities to organise amongst themselves things, which we put together in place after a few days' time. So we provided the networks, really, for people to be able to do that. We were therefore overrun by people we did not know who were doing a brilliant job. But it is a rather risky and scary thing to have your building taken over by lots and lots of people. Most of the time I had the very easy job of simply saying yes, because people would come up to me and say, Rev, can we do this? And in most cases it would be yes, please go away. And as long as so-and-so knows about it, that's fine. But it does raise all kinds of issues about what you allow in your building. And after a few days, we had to start restricting things even more. We had people who acted effectively as kind of bouncers on the door. So no children were allowed in the building, for instance, unless they were part of families of those who were survivors or those who were traumatised. We did have issues with one or two people who were behaving slightly inappropriately, and they got rather summary justice. You know, if someone's taken a photo inside the building that someone else doesn't like, they are just ejected. We haven't got time for actually sorting out the niceties of the things or devising policies for them. But it did make us think about, actually, we realised that we're flying by the seat of our pants. And inevitably in doing that, there will be mistakes that we make. And you want the church to be a place of safety, but you also want it to be a place where everyone can drop in. And sometimes those don't work entirely well together. We provided a lot of assistance to people in distress and in need, though some of it was not so much provided by the people as by the environment that's there. And I think the church did a lot of that, even if the church people themselves didn't do very much. We were the kind of the catalyst or the facilitator for lots of local people to be able to offer that to each other. And I think that happened a lot in our building and elsewhere. Much of which I've forgotten, but to give you one small example, a few months after the fire, I happened to come across a copy of Christianity magazine. And in it, there was an article about media intrusion and privacy. And it showed a picture taken outside the Methodist church of a grieving family following the fire. And I showed it to Susie. I did not remember anything of this, but Susie got very agitated at seeing the photo and said, "Don't you remember? You got really cross with the photographer and you took the family inside where they could be away from all the tons of camera crews outside the building because they were so upset." And I have I managed to summon up a vague memory of this happening. Wrote to Christianity magazine explaining that they might like to know the source of the actual photograph that had actually caused distress, and never got a reply. So they're not my favourite magazine, the Christianity magazine, for that reason. Holding vigils and memorials and silent marches has continued to be very profound, particularly for a population who, rightly or wrongly, feel that they have been ignored and marginalised for a very, very long time. So keeping up the memory of people when they're terrified that the world's media are going to move on, that their story is going to be forgotten, that nobody will care about what happened in Grenfell Tower in a few months' time, means that there's a lot of emotional energy in people turning out for the marches, which happen on the 14th of every single month. They're not hugely well attended, by and large, range from a few hundred to just a few thousand, and vigils on the anniversaries, such as particular events. The anniversary of the fire is one, the 6-month anniversary of the fire, the 18-month anniversary, All Saints Day, All Souls Day, has become a big event at our church, which becomes more like a kind of, I'm not sure if it's a service or a jamboree or a concert or a vigil, but it's some kind of event where the local community people simply turn up and say things and sing things about people who died in the fire. And I'm not really sure whether it's proper worship or not, I have to say. But people find it helpful, and the place is packed for that. We have had enormous amounts of cash and goods donated, and a phenomenal amount of money into the local community as a result. And I know that some big corporations have given lots of money, and some of there have been a lot of money still held by some major charities. They're still working out how to be able to distribute it, and I appreciate some of the difficulty of that if I get a chance later on. I don't want to bore you with all the detail. But the cash itself creates tensions, because certain community organisations get money and funding for things and projects and others don't. And there's a lot of rivalry that starts to develop between those who are regarded as bona fide survivors and those who live in their local community, who live right next to Grenfell Tower, who don't get anything. And when you saw Grenfell Tower earlier on the pictures, there's a lot of people who were made homeless who live right up against the tower, whose flats were destroyed by the debris and the smoke and the water damage, but are not regarded as Category A survivors because they didn't live in Grenfell Tower. So even though they will never be able to go back to their homes, the homes will be demolished, they'll not be able to retrieve their goods from most of their goods from their homes either because they've been damaged. People are in different kind of categories from A down to D. And I understand the reasons for that. But inevitably those things create tensions between the groups at times. Not all the time, but at times. There's been a huge media presence which has been both very helpful and very damaging. At first, people were very pleased to see the media because they wanted the story to be told. They wanted people to know about it, and they wanted to be heard because they felt they'd not had a voice for very long. And lots of people found that they could shout, and if they shouted loudly, people would pay attention to them, and they'd get airtime, and they'd be listened to by journalists and reporters, and so on. But the presence of lots of people wandering around with cameras for week after week and month after month does something to you if it's also your home and you live in the local community and people wander around with cameras at weekends looking rather like tourists. So the media has had an odd relationship with the local community, where they're often welcomed, but at times they're also challenged. So people will say, for instance, the one thing not to do before the tower was shrouded was to take a picture of the tower. If you did that, you got shouted at in the street. You really would get, lots of people would simply turn on you. That was regarded as the worst sin of all, for instance. And so there's a huge amount of sensitivity around these issues now. There was a Channel 4 programme last week, was it? A few days ago, a week or two, called Dispatches, which was on the fire brigades. Safety issues about Grenfell Tower, and that created mixed feeling in the local community. There were some calls for people to boycott it, which I found was quite interesting. It's the first media programme I've known which has provoked any form of opposition at all. Usually people are very pleased to have their stories being told. This, for whatever reason, was slightly different. And of course the church has been a go-to point for many people and organisations, and where we've been in a situation of being used for all kinds of things. For instance, we happen to be, as you've seen, very close to Grenfell Tower, which meant that after the fire, the police and the forensic crews set up their operation right opposite our building. And so their entrance to the site, where all the lorries and all the vehicles had to come in, was opposite our building, and they set up eventually lots of porter cabins and lots of kit and a whole infrastructure of hundreds of people who worked just opposite the building. But during that process, we were the local people around, so we had the photocopiers and we had the nice warm rooms for them to meet in, and we had nice toilets. So a lot of the senior police officers and the forensic crews would come over every day to use our nice loos, because they were a darn sight better than the loos that the police were providing for their own people. And for weeks they didn't have hot food, so there were all kinds of sort of teething issues. So we got to know some of them very well, and they would often use our building for all kinds of impromptu events, knowing that they could simply turn up and say, we just want to use a room, is that all right? Or on one occasion they borrowed our entire stock of kitchen ladles because they hadn't got any for all their crews over there. So there are lots of little ways. We had all their deliveries come to our church because they had no postal address. So if they order lots of winter clothing or whatever it is, they don't know where to deliver it because they don't have a postcode. You don't have a postcode, you don't get things delivered. So they would use our postcode, we'd get the delivery, and then they'd go and take it over. They're small things, but actually they help to make things work, and they were very much appreciated. And that's just about being available. And we've realised how helpful it can be as a church to actually have a building and a physical presence. I've been a minister nearly 30 years. For much of my upbringing, it was all about the work we do, and the building was a simple means to an end. It was all about the people. That's what I was taught about Methodism. Nothing about the building. It's all about the people. We're there to be a movement, and I do agree with that. We're a movement there for mission. But I've also realised how the building can signify an awful lot as well to local people, and how it can be used by a community and owned by a community to good effect as well. Next one. I'll have to... The local police chief, on the day in which she retired 6 months after the fire, said this about the church. You were the quiet people, this is about the Methodist church, who enabled others to be angry and to be sad. And that's my favourite quote, really. And helping people to express those things of real vitriolic anger and the deepest, lowest moments of sadness and grief and turmoil have been things that we've seen displayed in our church and in other churches and the mosque locally. If I show you the next slide, on the Friday after the fire was a Wednesday, 2 days after the fire, Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, came in the local area. He'd been there the previous day, but he came this day as well, and unannounced, with a few police officers, and was met by a much hostility outside the church as people learned that you know, an authority figure was in the area. And people, although some people wanted to listen to him and thank him for being around and showing support, a lot of people were shouting things at him as well. The mood got very angry indeed. It got very, very ugly later in that day as well. And as he came into our building, I think this is a photo taken by Sam, actually, my son, but as he came into the church building, people started throwing things at him. And we had to close the church. And he was barricaded inside our church for an hour while his mind had sorted out what to do and got extra police officers who could then come and gently escort him out 50 or so minutes later. We thought the church could be trashed. There were some really palpably ugly and angry scenes outside where things seemed to be boiling over. But allowing people to express anger at times can also be important. And we had lots of public meetings in the church and other centres, but many of them were in our church, where the police would convene a meeting between people from the local health authority, the local council, housing people and so on, fire brigade, public health, and the local population, and just say, turn up and ask your questions. And the media would be there, and we'd have 4 hours of shouting matches where people would be screaming.